Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley and this is the show which every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio brings you conversations that matter. Listen to around the world as well as a podcast. So wherever you are and however you're listening, welcome along. Very much looking forward to introducing my guests today, Jonathan Haidt and Andrew Wilson, to you. But we've had loads of response to last week's programme, the first of the new year, when Phil Moore and Natalie Collins debated the whole issue of egalitarian and complementarian theology. It was an inter-Christian debate last week, and that's generated an awful lot of response on both sides. I'll be bringing some of that towards the end of today's show. Don't forget you can watch that on video over at our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/premierunbelievable. Links, of course, there from the Unbelievable webpage too, where you can find links to the newsletter, the app, the features, the conference, the DVDs, the book, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And of course, links to the podcast, which is the way a lot of people listen to the show from week to week. Later on in the show, I'll also be telling you about some important events coming up very soon, actually, and live Unbelievable discussion event going on at the University of Southampton, which is going to be live cast. So listen out for that, and that'll be at the end of January. Very soon, though, Monday, the 14th of January, the regular Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic discussion group are meeting in London. I'll give you the details of a very exciting speaker they've got coming along for the next discussion. And also towards the end of today's show, I'll tell you about a very exciting interviewee I managed to sit down with for about half an hour this week to record with, one Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and a little bit of what we got into and when you'll be able to hear that too. For now though, time to get into today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, I'm really looking forward to our discussion with Jonathan Haidt, a moral psychologist and author. His books include The Righteous Mind and the recently published Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, written alongside Greg Lukianoff. Now, although he writes from a secular perspective, Jonathan's books have been widely acclaimed among many Christian leaders, and one particular fan joins us today, church leader and theologian Andrew Wilson. So, as trigger warnings, microaggressions, and no platforming have become part of our lexicon, we'll be unpacking Jonathan's critique of the conditions that have produced the so-called snowflake generation, and what the implications are for society and the church. I'm sure we'll be talking about morality and how we think about that as well during the course of the show. So Jonathan and Andrew, welcome along to the programme today.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you both. We'll come to you in a moment, Andrew, as someone who has been on the show before. Jonathan, your first time, so welcome along. It feels like cognitive psychology and all that stuff has become incredibly popular recently. You've obviously got Jordan Peterson, you've got Steven Pinker, you've got Sam Harris, all of them sort of feeding into this common interest. What's behind this this surge in public interest in this area, do you think, and what's your contribution to it at the moment?
Well, there is a huge rise in depression and anxiety, which we'll talk about. So that has brought more attention to issues of psychology and cognitive therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy is the most effective one. But I think there's also an odd thing going on, which is as our culture, as the academic culture and as American society more generally, is in a state of ferment and change, for some reason, a number of the people who have been active in talking about this have been psychologists. I don't know why. I'd like to think it's because this is a crisis brought on not just by economics and politics but and social media, but by strange quirks of human psychology. And so a number of psychologists have stood up to say, wait a second, the way we're reacting, the way we're behaving is really, really bad for us.
I'd like to talk about both of your recent books. We'll talk about The Righteous Mind a little later, but The Coddling of the American Mind, I believe that came from the title of an article you wrote for The Atlantic, but you've really kind of filled out a lot of that in this present book. Do you want to just give us a brief overview of what you're saying in this new book?
Oh, sure. So the article that we wrote in 2015, it was really the idea of my friend and co-author Greg Lukianoff, who is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and he is also prone to depression, and he had a very serious depression in 2007. He made concrete plans to kill himself.
Wow.
And at the last minute, he checked himself into a hospital. When he was released, he was enrolled in cognitive behavioral therapy. He learned how to catch distorted thoughts, how to question them, look for evidence. And he, like many people, credits this with saving his life and improving his thinking perpetually. And so he goes back to his job. And then in 2013, 2014, he begins to see for the first time, he begins to see college students asking for protections from words, books, speakers, and ideas. Previously, as the president of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, he was always pushing back against administrators, college presidents or deans who were putting in speech codes, basically to protect themselves from liability, usually. And now, for the first time, Greg was hearing students saying, if this book is assigned, it's going to traumatize people. If this speaker is allowed to come to campus, it's going to traumatize people. The people will have panic attacks. They might actually die. And so this is catastrophizing. It's mind reading. It's a variety of the exact cognitive distortions that Greg had learned to stop doing. And so Greg came to me in 2014. We'd met through a mutual friend. And he said, John, I'm seeing this strange pattern of thinking on campus. And if students are doing this, it's likely to make them depressed and anxious. So I thought this was a great idea. I'd begun to see and hear about this same sort of fragility among students. And we did some research. We wrote it up. At the time, we couldn't find proof positive that there was a rise in depression and anxiety. Lots of people on campus were talking about it, as though the campus mental health centers were flooded. But we couldn't find national evidence of a rise in depression among college students. That was 2014, 2015. So we published the article in 2015, in August. And then in November of 2015, all hell breaks loose on American college campuses because Halloween in America is a very scary time. There's always the danger that someone will wear a costume that will offend someone else. And so a wave of protests break out first at Yale, demands for more safe spaces, demands for a variety of things, but a basic idea that students are in danger in college and they need more protection. And this spreads nationally and it changes the norms of speech on campus. So things got so much worse after our article came out and we learned so much more, in particular about the rise of depression and anxiety, that we decided to expand it and write a book. And that book came out in September.
I know that you don't like to position yourself as a conservative. I think that's often where people see you, though, in the sense of positioning yourself at least against, you know, a kind of very left-wing progressive kind of viewpoint that might be inhabiting currently the colleges and universities and so on. I mean, what are you trying to do? You know, what's your aim in this if you're not sort of on either side necessarily?
Yeah, so one of the book is based on three great untruths. And the third untruth is, life is a battle between good people and evil people. And in times of conflict, generally there's an idea that if you're not with us, you're against us. That was more or less what George W. Bush announced to the world around the time of the Iraq War. And so some people on the left, because I have often criticized trends on the left, they assume I must be on the right because if you're not with us, you're against us. Now, I've never voted for Republican in my life. I support just about all the policy goals that people on the left support in the United States. But it is a sorry state of affairs. Things are so polarized that on both sides now, if you dissent from the dominant view of your team, you will be seen as the enemy by some. And that's where I am. Greg and I are basically, we have the personalities, the social profile of progressives. But people on the far left often dislike us people on the center-left, center-right, libertarians, Christians, Mormons, Jews, just about everybody who's not at either extreme does tend to like the message of the book.
That's interesting. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Andrew, our other guest here, Andrew Wilson, with me in studio, because you came out absolutely loving Jonathan Haidt's work, and think the first time you came across the first book you read of his, The Righteous Mind, you published a blog on Think Theology saying, "This is by far the best book of the year I've read," and I think you were aiming to read about 100 that year at the time.
Yeah, so. I really thought it was, and I totally concur with what John's just said about his own, at least from what I, reading around, thinking, yeah, that the positioning of this, you I think, particularly in The Righteous Mind, it was quite clear to me that you were the furthest to the right you were was centre-left, or at least that's the way it read in terms of a lot of the comments you made in passing. But the way that it seems to provoke, and probably less so even, I don't know, The Righteous Mind, what, 2014 or something? So
the 2012.
2012, oh, right. So the move between the publication of the two books is, I don't know if you got the same comments when The Righteous Mind came out, but certainly by now it looks like a very, in places, a critique. The more recent book looks like a critique of leftism, but actually it's, contains at a political level almost nothing on policy which has got anything at all to do with a critique of leftism. It's more a critique of, or at least it seems to me, both books combine to provide a critique of a sort of bullying culture in which you can't reason some of this stuff through. You just have to catastrophize, apocalypticize if you're not with us. So a lot of the things you've just said, I thought, yeah, that's my reading of it too.
And why has the book been so popular, especially among Christians, Andrew, would you say? If you can put
it, I can't speak for others. I think for me, there is an awful lot to it that I think probably articulates one of the reasons why it's very easy to feel like you feel like you're giving rational reasons for what you believe. You feel like you're articulating things, but there are certain things that have just instantly put you on the wrong side of morality, effectively.
And I think you're talking here about the righteous mind.
I think it comes through in both. There's a lot in the coddling. It's more, I think, about the, reflects the last 2 or 3 years very well. Mm. Whereas I think The Righteous Mind is making a more sort of foundational argument about the way that people come to the beliefs they have about morality and religion. And I think when you read it, even though, of course, there's some basic premises you don't accept as a Christian, in the sense that the outlook, of course, is theistic for me. But I think as you're reading it, you think this is describing very well the way in which I think disagreements between me and other people who disagree with me actually operate. It isn't simply a process of, well, and as you know, Jesse, because you do this the whole time. It's not just a rational disagreement between I have these premises and these conclusions. Mm. I feel things, and the other person feels things, and those sentiments are driving me to moral conclusions. And I also think that the thing about, if you're not familiar with John's work, that the taste buds, the idea that you have various ways of making moral choices, and the harm versus care axis, if you like, in our culture, if something's harmful, it's bad, and unless it's harmful, it's not bad. Whereas I think one of the things John's saying is there's other ways of making moral choices, and Christians resonate with some of those other ways as well as harm and care. And I think that was also a very significant eye-opener for me and probably others.
Actually, if I could jump in here on the question of why my books have been popular with Christians, I think we actually have to go back to my first book, The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, in which I surveyed ancient wisdom, East and West, from various millennia. And whenever a psychological claim was put forth over multiple millennia and East and West, I wrote it down, and I wrote a chapter on 10 of them. And so the Bible is the New Testament, both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, are full of insights about how to live a life. So if you want to know about chemistry and physics, there's no reason to read the ancients. They knew nothing that is helpful today. But if you want to know how to get along with people or how to manage your own heart and mind, my God, the Bible, Confucius, the Buddhists, the Stoics, they're just full of wisdom. And so that really opened my eyes to the value of attending to our traditions, the words that get passed down to us. It's not that the ancients were smarter than us. It's that they wrote a lot, they had a lot of insights, and what comes down to us is what has been filtered, what has been tested, what has been found useful. And so that's when I began really reorienting my thinking. I was a sort of a standard American scientific atheist Jew. I mean, I was not predisposed to like religion when I was in my 20s. But in the course of writing that book and in the course of doing my research on morality, I came to see that religion is part of human nature, that religions, at least it's very clear in America, religions as practiced, all religions, make people better. They bind them into communities that try to elevate each other morally. So here I was at the time when all these new atheists were writing these nasty, nasty books about religion and basically, you know, taking the Bible literally and saying, look at this, this is false. I was saying, no, actually, there's a lot of wisdom there. So I think that is one thing that drew Christians to my work. And then the second, as Andrew was saying, in The Righteous Mind, I talk about the full range of moral intuitions. And in Western secular philosophy and social science, morality has been reduced to don't hurt people and don't cheat them, don't treat them unfairly. But in fact, as I argue in the book, morality is actually really broad. If you look around the world, we have all kinds of intuitions about loyalty and respect for authority and sanctity. And I present these not as primitive things that we need to transcend, but as essential aspects of human nature that we harm ourselves and our societies if we ignore them. And so I think just by coming at questions of religion and flourishing with an open mind, not looking to indict anybody, just trying to explain, I think a lot of Christians in my country feel really misunderstood, chastised, demonized over a variety of issues. And here was somebody who was saying, you're not bad, you're actually pretty wise.
Yeah, I that chimes in, I think, to some extent with why I see a lot of Christians especially being very sympathetic to what people like Jordan Peterson are doing as well. And I don't know, Andrew, if this, what Jonathan has just said there, chimes with you, that it's a bit of a breath of fresh air to find people rather than slagging off religion.
I think so. What it reminded me of is C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, where he does something almost identical to what, I don't know if you read it even in your preparation on the happiness book, but that idea that there is an awful lot of consistent knowledge, wisdom that goes through the generations. And obviously, yeah, I know, imagine you must get compared to Jordan Peterson more than you'd, more times you could shake a stick at, and I imagine you must have been asked that. But I have preferences, but I do think that actually there's a number of people saying things of that same kind of nature, which is, it is the things that are widely believed in sort of secular liberal culture are not self-evidently true. They have to be substantiated. And in that sense, while you're not trying to make a religious argument, in many ways, you just create, there is a sort of a space created by that way of articulating things to say you have to establish things on the basis of reasoning for them and actually contending for them rather than just force of argument or raising your voice, which I think probably, I don't, it must be more true in the States, but probably to some degree in Britain as well. It just can sometimes feel to many people of a religious background that it's not a playing field which is level where you're able to debate and engage. It can feel at times like just by you get shouted down. And I think that a number of leading thinkers, including yourself, I think, sort of in the public square, articulating something which means, we've got to establish these things in some way logically, and they're not self-evident to everybody, and they probably won't be for some time.
I want to come back to these issues, which I think very much shine through in The Righteous Mind, but just coming back to the coddling of the American mind, can you explain the three great untruths that you unpack in that particular book, Jonathan?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. So the most important one in terms of getting our argument is the first one, which is what doesn't kill me makes me weaker. Now, there was a whole chapter in the Happiness Hypothesis on the quote from Nietzsche that I'm sure your listeners will think of, which is what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And what Nietzsche was onto, Mencius or Mengzi said something very similar, is that the human mind is anti-fragile, not fragile. That is, like the immune system, if you protect your kid's immune system, you don't expose them to peanuts and allergens and dirt and germs, you actually weaken the system, because the system must be exposed to all kinds of challenges in order to develop. Mm. And kids more generally are like this. If you protect your kids from being teased or insulted or excluded, if you could protect your child from all such things until the age of 18, would you do it? My God, if you did that, and then you send your kid off to the university, and the first time someone disagrees with her, she's not used to it. So that's, in a sense, what we've done to our kids, is we've taken kids who are naturally anti-fragile, who need thousands of hours of time playing with each other without any adult supervision to be able to make rules, work out rules, deal with social challenges. And in the United States, at least, we used to give that time to kids up until the 1990s. And then we freaked out about child abduction, just as our crime rate was plummeting. And we stopped letting them out. We literally stopped letting them out. Mm-hmm. Beginning in the 90s, if a kid was caught playing in a park, if a 10-year-old kid was caught playing in a park with a friend, the parents could be arrested. because that was considered child neglect, because what if someone steals the kids? So it was absurd, it was paranoid, but that's what we did. Anyway, back to the list of truths. So kids are anti-fragile, but we're treating them as though they're fragile.
And if I could just interrupt for a moment, I came across a new phrase the other day, which is helicopter parenting. I don't know if you've heard that one, Jonathan.
Oh, thank God. We've got helicopter parenting, snowplow parenting, concierge parenting.
Oh, wow.
The idea that we developed in the 90s was that our kids are not competent, they're not safe, they're not capable, we have to do everything for them. And then, of course, they don't learn how to become autonomous adults. And then we ship them off to the university where they now find books, speakers, words, and ideas threatening and ask adults for protection. We have made them morally dependent.
There you go. And number two of these great untruths you're about to unpack.
Yeah, number two is always trust your feelings. Now, that sounds like good advice. You know, may the force be with you. And I wrote my last book about the power of intuition. But here's the thing. If you're angry, if you're anxious, this colors your thought and in many ways distorts it. And one of the greatest insights of the ancients is exactly this, that you have to challenge these ideas. So as Epictetus put it, what really frightens and dismays us is not external events themselves, but the way in which we think about them. It is not things that disturb us, but our interpretation of their significance. Buddha said, our life is the creation of our mind. And this is what you learn in CBT. When Greg learned to do cognitive behavioral therapy, what he learned is that if he says something and then he thinks it was a stupid thing to say, and then he goes off on a, you know, my God, this is going to be terrible. Now people think I'm stupid. Now I won't get hired, or I won't, you know, that's catastrophizing. That's mind reading. And you actually have to challenge those thoughts and look for evidence. Basically, we should not always trust our feelings. We should actually challenge them sometimes and try to get them in line with reality. If you always go with them, that's actually a recipe for depression and anxiety.
And the way that this is being expressed on our campuses and education systems and so on in society, you feel is turning people into a I have a right to not be offended kind of viewpoint.
Well, that's right. So there's the idea that no one can question anyone else's experience. So if someone... You know, if someone says this is a hostile place for women or for LGBT, no one can say, oh, really, tell me what? Like, why do you think that? You don't in any way want to be seen to be questioning their judgment. That's called a micro-invalidation. So the idea that people have their own truth, their own lived experience, and we shouldn't challenge that. You know, that's not to say that a place is not racist or homophobic, but If we can't have a discussion about it, if people's perception, people's feelings are supposed to be respected and reified and never challenged, that's a recipe for escalation, for self-marginalization. It makes it difficult to have discussions. And so especially in a college classroom, if we can't openly argue with people, people can just say, well, I feel this. I don't need to provide any other evidence. It kind of shuts down discussion.
Yeah. And you've obviously also outlined at the beginning the third one, life is a battle between good people and evil people is the other great untruth, and saying it simply That's isn't right. as simple as that. What was your takeaway from these untruths and the way Jonathan unpacks them in this new book, Andrew?
I mean, I read a review, as you said, and I found it fascinating because I think they resonated a lot with me. I think you don't want to be the guy who reads the book and goes, yes, that's exactly what I've already believed. There were a number of examples. I think particularly tracing the thing that surprised me the most actually was the extent to which some of this development was very recent. And I don't think I'd seen that, the extent to which I think you drew some, John, I don't want to get this wrong, that some data about the development even between 2012, 2013, 2014 through to today and that's change. Is that right? Is that about the time scale in terms of this becoming significantly worse on campus in the last five
that's
or six
right.
years?
So this is the, one of the crucial things that people need to realize, and this is not just in the United States. This is in the UK. I was just over in London for a week. It's in Canada. It's that childhood change for kids born in 1995 and afterwards. So we used to think that kids born in the 80s and 90s were millennials and that would go up through maybe 1998 or 2000. But it turns out, in a book by Jean Twenge called iGen, she graphs out all kinds of data we have on kids born for the last 30 or 40 years. And she shows that kids born in 1995, things just really change. And so the reason, we think, is because they've been overprotected, as I said, in the 90s. And then the main thing is that this is the first generation that gets social media in middle school when they're ages 10, 11, 12. So it's really hard to be that age. It always was, and it's especially hard for girls. And then suddenly, these kids get iPhones and social media. You know, the iPhone's introduced in 2007, but it's very expensive. And it's not till about 2010 or 11 that most teenagers have one. And so now they can check social media hundreds of times a day. Girls' aggression tends to be more relational rather than physical. And so girls can damage each other's relationships, do more social comparison, feel more inadequate. For a variety of reasons, the rates of depression and anxiety begin to skyrocket for teenage girls right around 2011, 2012. And it's only in 2013, 2014, that academic year, that these new ideas come onto campus. And that is exactly when the oldest members of iGen arrive. If you're born in 1995, you first show up at an American university in 2013. And so as iGen or Gen Z, as they replace the millennials on campus, they bring in these new ideas. They see themselves as much more fragile. They do, in fact, have much higher rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide. And they behave differently in class. There's evidence showing that depressed and anxious people will interpret ambiguous situations to be much more negative and threatening. And it's very difficult to persuade them otherwise. And so this is what Greg and I were so surprised by. And this is what has happened at schools all across the country. And you're beginning to have it in the UK, too. You have exactly the same profile of increasing mental illness, except your boys are not getting worse necessarily. Our boys and girls are in bad shape, but our girls are in much worse shape. In the UK and Canada, it seems to be almost only the girls.
Wow. Andrew, do you want to respond to that? I mean, I was interested to read in your review that when it came to some of the solutions being offered by Jonathan and his co-writer in this book, you felt that there was actually a lot that overlapped with biblical wisdom.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was going to say. Like, I think that the bit that I didn't know, which and I mean, not the only bit, but, you know, the bit that I found most kind of, wow, was the bit we've just talked about. But I think in some ways, the prescriptions seem to me to be a mixture, as you say, of ancient wisdom and things which you just say, all of those things would be effectively, and this is, I think, the point you made, John, already, that they resonate, and no doubt not just only with biblical writings, but with other ancient wisdom, but particularly as you're reading, you know, those three key untruths and the responses to them, you think, I can find that, all three of those in Paul, I can find all three of those in the Torah, I can find all three of those in the Jewish prophets. And in the teaching of Jesus. And at that point, thinking, wow, this is really interesting that what these guys are doing is stitching together a very big contemporary problem with a very biblically resonant sort of answer. And of course, at that point, you go, well, this is both fascinating, but also helping me adapt and think through, giving me new glasses, I suppose, with which to see a way in which Christianity and the culture overlap. And so at that level, even as a pastor or a writer, it was very helpful. But I think it introduced a lot of categories about why that had become particularly acute recently that I'd never seen. And I thought it was really interesting.
And Andrew, if you won't read the quotes from your review, then I will. Paul, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance character, and character produces hope. I mean, that's anti-fragility right there. That's a much better
totally.
Raise kids than telling them that they're fragile and that they need to be protected from words. And, you know, speaking of ancient wisdom and biblical wisdom, it just occurred to me recently when I was watching, you know, groups of kids all sitting around, not talking to each other, but just connecting on their devices. And it occurred to me that there has never been a generation in human history, probably anywhere on the planet, that was as disconnected from the thinking of people 20 years older than them than we have now. And so think about, you know, when we were growing up, when any previous generation was growing up, you encounter all sorts of things. And a lot of what you encounter was written more than a month ago. A lot of it was written more than 100 years ago. And if you look at, if you could somehow analyze all the ideas, words, and images coming into a kid's eyes and ears, and you look at the percentage that were created within the last week, it would be very, very high. And the percentage that were created more than 100 years ago would probably be close to zero for a lot of them.
That is such a...
They're hyper-connected to each other, but they are disconnected from ancient wisdom.
Yeah, it is a huge irony in the sense that we've got more information than ever at our fingertips, but in a sense we've chosen to keep our scope of what we decide to feed ourselves narrow.
And a thing which I thought of as well on the ancient wisdom thing, again, it's another Lewisism, but again, I just think one of the reasons I resonated with your work, because I can see there's a sort of, it's a, like a sort of secular C.S. Lewis in many ways. There's just some things he says in his introduction to Athanasius's book on the incarnation, where he says, you know that, he's speaking in the 40s, that you know that Mr. Hitler and Mr. Roosevelt agree 100% on a whole bunch of things that would be utterly unthinkable to Thomas Aquinas or Augustine or Plato. And that's the challenge, is that if you only deal with people in your own time frame, you might seem diverse in the sense that you're hearing from different voices and different communities. But if you're not hearing from different centuries, you're actually blind to some enormously obvious things that pretty much everybody in the human race would say, you can't possibly believe that. And yet it would seem immensely obvious to everyone alive today.
We're going to go to a very quick break, and we'll be back in a moment's time, talking on Unbelievable today with Jonathan Haidt. He's a moral psychologist, author of books such as The Righteous Mind and the recently published The Coddling of the American Mind. In conversation today with Andrew Wilson, do keep listening. This is the show that aims to get you thinking.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity, from a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the programme. A really interesting conversation today on Unbelievable between Jonathan Haidt, who's a moral psychologist and author. Now, he's already said he's essentially a secular. I don't know if you class yourself specifically as agnostic or atheist these days, Jonathan. Is that?
I call myself an atheist.
Okay. And yet, the book's much, you know, acclaimed, as we said, by people on the religious side. And what's interesting, I think, with the Righteous Mind, the book you wrote several years ago now, was that you were identifying the fact that, to a great degree, the reasons we believe things, the moral opinions, religious, political views we take, are less guided than we often like to say or think by our analytics reason, but much more by our intuitions and commitments that kind of are guided by all kinds of other things. You've described it as being likened to an elephant and a rider. Do you want to just explain that metaphor, which has become quite popular since you wrote it?
Oh, yes. So chapter one of my first book, The Happiness Hypothesis, reviews the essential psychological insight that shows up in every culture that leaves us writing about wisdom. And that is that the mind is divided into parts that sometimes conflict. And so the challenge is to think about, all right, what's the relation between these parts? And the one that is given to us by Plato in the Phaedrus is that the mind is like a charioteer steering two horses. And the charioteer is reason, and reason, if he can control the unruly horses, the noble horse of the noble emotions and the base horse of the baser desires, then you have a man who's governed by reason. So that's a nice image if you're a philosopher and you're saying everyone should study philosophy. But here I was writing this book when I was in my early 30s, and I was teaching a course in psychology at the University of Virginia, and it just didn't feel that way to me. It just felt like, you know, especially when I would fall in or out of love or try to end a relationship and not do what I really knew that I ought to do, it felt a lot more like the automatic parts, the emotive parts, were gigantic, and the reasoning part was this little tiny thing that was often quite ineffective. And so I used the metaphor instead, that the mind is divided into parts like a rider, a small rider, which is conscious reasoning, on the back of a very large and powerful elephant, which is intuition or automatic processes. And I think it's a better metaphor because an elephant is really big and really smart compared to horses. And this is what we see in psychology, that our intuitions are actually very smart, and they exist in dialogue with our reasoning. And when we really want to do something, our reasoning tends to be a servant, not a master. So as David Hume put it, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can pretend to no other office than to serve and obey them. A lot of my early work was basically showing that David Hume was right.
It sounds very Augustinian to me. I don't know how much Augustine you've probably read some.
Please tell us how.
But he has this sort of very strong idea that human beings are basically the loves. I mean, I know it's a subtly different point, I suppose, from the idea of the intuitions, but the idea that it is the desires of the person, which I think is actually very similar to what you mean in your description of the elephant, the desires of the person, the loves of the person, therefore that is what's actually wrong with human beings insofar as we've been corrupted by sin, is not knowledge in the sense of the cognitive faculties, but it is disordered loves. That's really where we go wrong. And that what our mind often then does, and the lovely thing about Augustine is, of course, he does it in the Confessions. He sort of walks through his own description of how his desires led him into places that now in his reason he can see were wrong, and has these stories which become quite famous about, you know, stealing a pear just because he wanted to do something transgressive, and, you know, all those sort of quite, you know, give me chastity but not yet, those sorts of famous bits are in the context of a personal narrative, which I think lives out very well the sort of rider-elephant dynamic you're talking about. And I think if you were to show that image to Augustine, I think he'd say, yeah, that's pretty much, he would probably give the word desire or love to the elephant rather than intuition. But I think the idea that your cognitive faculties are effectively backfilling explanations for what your heart wants to do is very similar to what I think you were saying in The Right's Mind. And so again, it was one of those ones where I'm reading it going, this smells of something very familiar to me. I just think it's very interesting coming from a moral psychologist rather than a Christian theologian, but coming to very similar conclusions.
Do you have any clue that you were essentially
channeling
Augustine at the time you wrote The Righteous Mind?
Not while I was writing it, but let's talk about moral education, because I do think that Christians are particularly wise to the fact that moral education it can't be just lectures, it can't be just teachings, that it takes a long time, and that it's about it's about repetition, it's about behavior, it's about norms. In the United States, many devout Christians try to shelter their kids from the larger culture. I think, quite frankly, that they're right you have to protect you have to think about the development of the elephant as well as the rider. And the elephant are unconscious processes. Kids are very, very shaped by what other kids are doing and saying. They soak things up sideways, not just down from the parents. So if you look at raising a child as a matter of raising this complex thing that is both rider and elephant, and you have to speak to both, you have to attend to the moral development of both, the relations between them are complicated, and it's best done in a community. So I think that religious communities often do a good job of moral education, where secular communities end up kind of backing off and saying, well, you know, if we don't agree, like in public schools, if we don't agree on what morality is, well, we better just not say anything about it. And so we'll just say, don't cheat on tests, be tolerant of racial and gender diversity. And beyond that, we don't have much to say, and we just focus on academic instruction. I think that's a mistake.
I'd be interested to know to what extent you think that kind of the elephant can be inculcated. I mean, do you think that religious communities have had a particularly strong role in doing that? Do you feel that as we become a more post-Christian or post-religious society, that's more difficult to do? What's going on in the bigger picture?
No, I do think that. I do think that's right. We just, in the United States here, we just said goodbye to President George H.W. Bush, president in the 1990s, and all the commentary talks about how he was such an exemplar of the WASP virtues, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant virtues. And the coverage is very, very positive, especially nowadays. Here we are in the age of Trump. The contrast between the two men is just stunning. And one thing that was notable about George Bush, the elder, is that he often would not say the pronoun I. You know, he wouldn't say, I want to do this. He would say, I don't even know how we do it, but he'd somehow say, we want to do this. He would just, it sounds funny because he wouldn't say I, because his mother really taught him to stop putting yourself first, stop having so much ego, be humble. And so virtues of humility, virtues of service, these are beautiful. These are hard to inculcate if it's not part of a larger tradition linked to religious commandments. So I think that tight religious communities do have a lasting effect, just as time in the military for many years has a lasting effect. Now, a lot of people who've gone through, especially Catholic schools in the United States, will often complain about it. I'm not saying that they're always good. They can be too harsh. But I think that when you control the environment of a kid and you control their practices and behavior, and you have teachings and you have moral exemplars and you trigger moral emotions on a regular basis over years, then you can do things that are very hard to do in a diverse secular society where we are more in a sort of a Tower of Babel situation where we're, there are many competing norms, so it's hard to put any into the kid.
Hmm. I mean, Andrew, was it the Jesuits who said, you know, give me the child until the age of Leona, seven and we will give you the man and so on? So yeah, what I guess there's a lot to agree with here.
Absolutely.
It's coming from a secular, psychological point of view.
This is why I think Christians have enjoyed your work, John, and it's why I did. It's not like it's just, I hope it's not just confirmation bias where I'm enjoying it because it says what I already believe. And there are obviously a bunch of things you say that are coming from completely different standpoints to me, but it's so interesting how when it cashes out, it's so similar. I think the point you've just made is, even if you took it away from Christianity, it's so obviously true of the Jewish people, where you'd say there's an incredibly strong, like, sort of, you know, I think Judaism is itself a very striking example of the point you've just made about how catechesis, or at a cognitive level, when framed inside a much more narrative and liturgical and symbolic laden world, means that even when people are without a land for thousands of years and being persecuted for much of that time, there's still an ability to form an imagination and a series of desires and loves, which is not simply a series of information which is being passed down, but actually a way of seeing the world and a way of understanding. And I think Christian liturgy is effectively an attempt to do that. And I think, from my sort of particular background, where there's a sort of charismatic experience mingled with a desire for sort of a liturgical rootedness as well, I think a very, hopefully, an attempt to learn from some of these insights almost in the way that you are trying to catechize and strengthen people. Because you recognize, actually, if you don't get the elephant, that you can tell the rider as much as you like, but it's probably not going to work.
I just wanted to say, when Andrew's describing the history of the Jews, the Jews were able to create a moral matrix. Every group creates a moral matrix, a kind of a network of meanings and understandings of the world and moral regulation. The Jews created one and carried it with them throughout the Exodus. And of course, it changed as Jews went through Eastern Europe or North Africa. But yes, the continuation of the Jewish people with some recognizable ideas and approaches, I think, is a remarkable testament to the power of a religion to shape future generations.
I had a few people get in touch when I told them we were hosting this discussion, Jonathan, and one or two questions came up that I think are quite interesting, because at the end of the day, you do approach things, obviously, from a kind of very much an evolutionary paradigm, from you don't import a theistic worldview in any sense into the results that you have here. John Dixon, who's a Bible scholar in Australia, says, I'm forever fascinated, especially with a thinker like Haidt, and whether he thinks the various moral paradigms he describes have a higher rational grounding than A, social cohesion, or B, evolutionary instinct. What's your response to that? Does it all ultimately boil down to evolution, social cohesion, and the kind of advantages given to us by that?
Yeah. There are deep questions here about moral truths, and maybe it's worth saying here that my fundamental disagreement with Sam Harris is over the nature of moral truth, where Harris wants to claim, or claims in one of his books, that moral truths are true like the truths of chemistry or physics. And some people think that either something is a moral fact or else it's just an opinion or a preference. Mm. I tend to think that morality is something that emerges as people interact. Moral truths are emergent. And so, it is a fact that gold is more valuable than silver. That's not just my opinion, it's a fact. But it's only a fact about the way that people interact with each other. And so, I think moral truths are like this. There is a general tendency in history to find larger forms of cooperation. The Old Testament in particular, the Hebrew Bible, is full of groups competing with groups and often wiping them out. Life was a zero-sum battle over a limited amount of land. And moral progress has been finding new ways to cooperate, new ways to live together, to get used to each other, to achieve benefits of trade and peace and prosperity and mutual respect. So I think there is in some way a direction to human evolution, to moral evolution. Robert Reich talks about this in the book Non-Zero. This is a roundabout way of saying that I don't I don't have a good answer to your listener in Australia, except to say that because I don't believe that there is a higher power, I don't believe that there is any conscious direction to evolution, but yet I do see that there are trends and patterns in the way that human societies evolve. And here I'm drawing also on Steven Pinker's recent books. I think we don't have to just say, oh, it's just, you know, one evolved mechanism after another with no point, no direction, nothing good, kind of depressing. We're just animals. Well, yeah, we are animals, but my goodness, we are a very different kind of animal, and we do have moral progress, I would say.
I wonder if this is one area, at least, where you might start to diverge a little from some of Jonathan's conclusions, Andrew.
Oh, yeah. you would think you'd be surprised if I didn't when you said, oh, yeah, I totally agree. I think it's fascinating. I think John's question is really, as in John Dixon's question, is really interesting because I think, and clearly this is, again, I feel like I'm a broken record here, because this is where you and Lewis are obviously so different, because at this point, Lewis says, well, the very structure of evolution, of the evolutionary argument, and I, you know, believe in almost all of what I think you would on evolution as a mechanism level, as a personally, but the whole structure of the argument is effectively that you preserve those beliefs or practices which are going to help you survive, and in a sense, therefore, you've got no basis to say this is actually true. In the end, you just say this is
useful.
It's useful. It's going to be, and it's interesting in because I think you write with such a. What seems like to me is a very sort of strong moral framework that although I don't think you ever come out and say this ought to be true. You're basically, it's a descriptive project you're undertaking, isn't it? Yet even so, there seem to be in the background a sort of a right sense that these things should be so, that X is actually better morally than Y. And I think you're absolutely right about that. And I just think it's quite interesting that is obviously a position that pushed to an extreme, a purely evolutionary account of morality is only ever going to be descriptive. It will only say we have got to this point and this tends to be what we regard as good without any real grounding that's actually good. And if we started round up the clock and done it a different way, we might end up with human rights as a bad thing, or the dignity of the human, which obviously I think is a very Christian weighted concept, the image of God, it is something we don't need, and in fact it's going to help my tribe to wipe yours out. And I know that that's not what has happened, but I just think that's where the move from the descriptive to the prescriptive, obviously within the evolutionary framework you would use, is obviously a move you can't really make at a logical level without invoking some sort of transcendence. And so that's obviously where we would be different. But I think it's quite interesting seeing you explore that.
What's your feeling on that? Do you feel like there is any level at which you see evidence for a kind of transcendent aspect to the sense that we often have implicitly that these things are objectively true, that there are really right and wrong ways to live your life and to go about and treat your neighbor and so on?
Yeah, so I was invited to give a talk at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, an organization of Christian colleges in the United States. And one piece of my talk, I found the quote from Pascal, there's a God-shaped hole in the heart of each man. And the actual quote, he's more or less said that, but the actual quote, let me just find the exact quote. He said, "There was once in man a true happiness, of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace. This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him, though none can help. Since this infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object, in other words, by God himself." So I read that to the audience and I said, you know, I come at this from studying evolution and human nature, but I agree with you that there is a God-shaped hole in the heart of every man. In The Righteous Mind, I talk about how I think we evolved to be religious. And so me and that audience, we can disagree about how that hole got there. But part of living with diversity, part of living in a diverse society, is we have to find ways to live alongside each other and live with some inconsistencies. And when we do find ourselves having come to the same place by different means, saying, you know, that's okay. We got here by a different way, but here we are. Let's talk about this. And the implications for how you raise kids, the implications for how you give people a sense of meaning and purpose in a society in which more and more people feel things are chaos, things are meaningless, things are hopeless. If we all agree that humans yearn for something larger, they want to be part of something larger. They don't just want lots of money and pleasure and things to look at. They actually want a sense of meaning and connection and purpose. Well, actually, we can help each other. We can live alongside each other. We can be allies and friends. And so that's what we explored in the rest of the talk, is what Christian educators can do in the United States at a time when our secular universities are experiencing quite a lot of problems. I don't know. Does that get us a little closer?
Yeah,
very interesting.
It is very interesting. And as you say, interesting that you recognize that Pascal was right. You may just disagree, I guess, on where that God-shaped hole came from, as it were. I mean, it strikes me, though, that in all the things you've said, you strike a very different note to, for instance, Sam Harris, who almost seems to be saying a lot of the time what he's saying: if we can just be more rational, if we can just get everything rationally straight in our head, then we'll live the lives we should live, because it'll all be obvious to us what we should be doing with our lives. And obviously he sees religion as very much antithetical to that purpose. So why do you come to such a different conclusion, do you think, to someone like Sam, who I guess has the same ultimate grounding for everything in terms of he thinks it's an evolutionary psychological thing, but he sees religion as somehow completely going against what we should be doing in life?
That's right. Well, I think Sam is more of a rationalist than I am. Now, I could very well have become Sam Harris. I think we're similar in a lot of ways in our personalities. We just took different turns in our research. Sam, I don't know his early history. I've been on his podcast twice. I should just point out he and I were sort of enemies for a while. I've rarely had academic enemies, but we were sort of enemies for a while at conferences. And we actually made up, and we've had a really good time talking to each other. I think he has mellowed a bit as he's gotten older. And I do admire his courage. He talks about a lot of issues at a time when many Americans are just afraid of the reaction. And Sam has a lot of guts. But I do think that he has a kind of a faith. I would actually use the word faith in reason that I do not share. And as a psychologist who studies moral reasoning, boy, do I not have faith in reasoning. Our reasoning is motivated. Our reasoning is biased. And so I am a big, big fan of systems that we have found or created that correct for the flaws in our reasoning. So if you just get a committee of very, very smart people to study a problem, you put them together, and it's a complicated problem. If it's an engineering problem, they're going to get it. If it's what's called a tame problem, they're going to figure it out. But if it's a wicked problem, one that is affected by the preconceptions we bring, like what should we do about poverty or war or Brexit or financial regulation or just about anything else, anything complicated, we bring our prejudices and biases to it, and we tend to find evidence to support the solutions that we want to impose. So that's why I'm such a fan of viewpoint diversity. That's why I think in the social sciences in particular, we must have people who are on the left and the right. We have to know that our claims will be challenged. And that's why I co-founded an organization called Heterodox Academy with some other social scientists and law professors who were concerned that in American universities, it doesn't matter if they lean left, that's not a problem. But when you have communities where nobody is not on the left, then the quality of the thinking declines. So I think that there are a few differences between me and the new atheists, even though we generally take an evolutionary approach.
Yeah. Did you get that sense?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think full circle, almost back to where we started. I think that's why I enjoyed your books. And I think that's probably why a lot of people have, because I think when you live as if in a funny way, you live as a minority, which, of course, in a pluralistic society, to some degree, everybody does, because there's always fewer people who believe what you believe than believe something different. But when you know, and certainly in a British context, and I don't know, Justin might know, 3-5% of the country, evangelical Christians, but something, you know, it's a very small amount, basically. So most of the media you consume, most of the news you hear, most of the comment and opinion is by people who strongly disagree with you. So you are used to living with ideological diversity, even if you live in a fairly monocultural sort of context. You might live in a very middle-class white town, and you might be middle-class white yourself, but you're living with a sense of continual, I don't mean this word in a negative sense, but assault or challenge or confrontation to your deeply held beliefs just by virtue of living in a largely secular culture. That'd be less true in the States, I dare say, but in Britain it's true for everybody who's a Christian believer or any religious believer. And so hearing things like that is often the appeal, because you think, actually, I've had to do this, and we all do, because you're living in a context where you've got to figure out how you're going to get alongside people who have wildly different beliefs on some pretty big issues to you, and work about how to live peacefully and happily, and how to love your neighbour, which in the end is what we're all trying to do. And so I think that's what I found so resonant about a lot of the things you were saying. I thought this helps me answer and helps me see the interface between broadly Christian wisdom, which I have absorbed over some years and seen in scripture, but also seeing this is actually probably what the best wisdom in the world is saying as well, and the two of them are lining up in many ways on what to do about it, which is very helpful.
Yeah. And if I could add a comment here, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, Andrew, I host this show, which very frequently is bringing Christians and non-Christians kind of at sort of both ends of the spectrum together for dialogue and debate and tussling with the intellectual rational issues, if you like. But I've always felt there's always more going on, that you don't tend to, in a sense, convince someone of the truth of Christianity simply by a clever intellectual argument. There's a whole thing, the elephant underneath is something you have to engage with at some point. If you simply cast it as an intellectual exercise, then you're kind of only dealing with the top level sort of stuff going on. And I wonder if that was helpful for me. I found that helpful with The Righteous Mind and so on, that we have to understand people as a whole rather than as some kind of just intellectual.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways it helped. I'm thinking as a pastor, I've used this material in training pastors on thinking about ethics and morality, and it actually saying even about things like discipleship, about formation of character within your church. If you just simply teach people, then you don't get people engaging the dreaming or imaginary or loving, desiring, intuitive side of the person. And some of our catechesis is quite like that and can be quite dry. You just won't engage with the person. You won't win that person.
Who was it who said that you don't have to just show someone that something's true? You've got to make them want it to be true. I think.
Well, this is where I go Pascal, you see. So that's what lovely to hear you quoting Pascal, because Pascal said it, and I think that this is such a great summary of a lot of this stuff. And he's very Augustinian himself. He's a Jansenist. So he says you can't try and persuade somebody by trying to simply reason through. What you need to do is three things to convince somebody of the truth of Christianity, or, and I dare say, anything. So first of all, you've got to show that it is worthy of respect, otherwise you won't get a hearing. Secondly, you have to make good people wish it were true, and only thirdly can you demonstrate that it is. Whereas, of course, what an awful lot of, I guess, Christian apologetics and any kind of apologetics
starts at
three and goes, we've got to try and convince you that it's true. Whereas actually they don't want it to be true, and their elephant is heading off into the jungle while they're trying to.
Is all about the fact that we do tend to reason from what we want to be true in the first place. That's where the intellectual side, which is expressed so well in the book. Jonathan, if you've got time to stay with us for just a few more minutes, we're going to go to a break and we'll do some summing up. Is that all right?
Yeah, I can do that.
Great, fantastic. You're listening to a discussion between Andrew Wilson and Jonathan Haidt on today's edition of Unbelievable.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable. Conversation this week between John Haidt, moral philosopher, and Andrew Wilson, church pastor and theologian. And we'll be returning to that very shortly. Remember, if you like Unbelievable, you'll also like our newsletter. I'm pretty certain of that. It comes out every 2 weeks, packed with stuff from the latest show, bonus content, features, stuff that you will be interested in if you enjoy Unbelievable. So do get yourself registered if you're not already. It's available. It's a link from the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I also promised at the outset of the show to tell you about a special interview I had this last week with none other than the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Got to sit down with him for about half an hour at Lambeth Palace here in London to talk about various things, including Thy Kingdom Come, which is a fabulous initiative, not just from the Anglican Church, but being joined by all the churches here in the UK and globally up to Pentecost. It's a prayer initiative. You'll hear about that when we release the interview, and we go on to talk about prayer and evangelism, talking about the church, politics, Brexit, and sexuality, transgender, lots of stuff that we cover in that particular interview. So look out for that. You can hear some of it actually this coming week on our Inspirational Breakfast show on Premier Christian Radio in the morning. But you will be able to hear more of it thereafter, and we'll be releasing it on the Unbelievable feed as well. Coming up after Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio, Alex Williams will be speaking to Jack Phillips of the Masterpiece Bakery. If that rings a bell, it's because he was at the centre of the US's gay cake case. And he'll be talking about that whole controversy and the results of it to Alex on The Profile this afternoon. And in the second half of The Profile, Sam Hales will be speaking to his most godly beatitude, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, Theophilus III. So look forward to that on The Profile this afternoon, and available, of course, on its own podcast as well. Got a couple of events to tell you about. Firstly, there's going to be an evening with Dr. Dennis Alexander on theistic evolution. It's happening at the Unbelievable Discussion Group in London this Monday, the 14th of January. They're at a new location this time. It's changed to a cocktail bar, just 2 minutes up the road from their regular location. The Cock Tavern, 23 Phoenix Road, NW1 1HB, still between Euston and King's Cross. And of course, Dr. Dennis Alexander, regular guest on Unbelievable. He's author of books such as Creation or Evolution? Do We Have to Choose? Is There Purpose in Biology? Which you obviously discussed on the show back in August. So they're really looking forward to welcoming him to the group, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people turning up to ask him questions and discuss afterwards. More details about that at their meetup.com website. You're looking for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group in London. Another little event that I want to tell you about, exciting to be joined again by John Lennox for a live discussion debate event. And he'll be opposite another Unbelievable favourite, Peter Atkins. Yes, good old Peter Atkins and John Lennox going to be in discussion on Can Science Explain Everything? So this is actually being held at Southampton University. It's a university student event on Thursday, the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m. So if you're at the university, please do come along. Now, that's not going to be open to the public, only to students. But if you'd like to go to where it's being streamed live nearby at Highfield Church in Southampton, that's a great location to turn up to if you're in the area. That's on Thursday, the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m. And it will be live streamed on the Unbelievable YouTube channel as well. So I'm really looking forward to bringing two very eminent scientists and thinkers together for that discussion on Can Science Explain Everything? John Lennox and Peter Atkins, hosted by myself. Look out for that. I'll remind you again of that next week as well. And it will appear as an edition of Unbelievable on the podcast in due course as well. So there's a couple of things to look forward to. Pop them in your diary if you can. Not forgetting, of course, a little bit further down the line, but well worth ring fencing to make sure you're available, the Unbelievable Conference 2019 in London on Saturday, the 20th of July. Hoping to get that booking page open soon, and we can tell you all about the brilliant guests, topics and stuff that we're going to be doing on the day. But do make sure it's free in your diary if you want to come. Saturday, the 20th of July for this year's UK Unbelievable Apologetics Conference. Some of your thoughts on recent editions of the show coming up after we finish our dialogue between Jonathan Haidt and Andrew Wilson.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Jonathan, thanks so much for being on the show today. I mean, one of the things that we were sort of saying in the last section of the programme just then was what it takes to get people to change their mind. And we do live in a very polarised sort of culture now where it feels like everyone's shouting at each other and no one seems to be willing to listen and to be open to other ideas a lot of the time. I mean, for you, what would it take, for instance, to change your mind on something, whether it be a political, religion or something else? What is the kind of process that you feel you would have to go through to change your mind yourself?
Well, I think there has to be a narrative to replace it. So it's very hard to simply knock out a belief if it's linked in with other beliefs by which you make sense of the world. Mm. And then often there has to be a peak moment of that feels like insight, where you can feel the mental category shifting. So just to give one example, when I took my family, we spent 3 months traveling across Asia. I was doing research for a book that I'll be writing on morality and capitalism. And in Korea, just seeing how much of childhood is devoted to preparing kids for a test that they'll take to get into the university. And it was really sad. The kids, they go to school, and then after school and on weekends, they go to cram school to prepare for the test. And seeing, I had a real feeling of sadness or tragedy, seeing kids who are deprived of childhood play almost entirely for many, many years. And so that really changed my thinking about about certain things about education and about high stakes testing. We have to find ways. We have to find ways to admit not just on a test that people can spend their whole life studying for. So anyway, I'm just saying that this was a very moving experience for me, which changed my mind on certain things about American education.
Yeah, that's an interesting example you give there. I've sometimes asked this question of some atheist and Christian guests who join me. Maybe they've had some high level debate on, you know, the evidence for God from science or the universe or philosophy or something. And I finally said, maybe to sort of a very strong atheist, what kind of evidence would change your mind? And it's interesting, very often they, if you say, well, could the stars lining up saying God exists, believe in me?
Yeah.
And even that isn't necessarily good enough, though, because, hey, advanced alien technology could create that kind of a scenario. What if Jesus appeared to you in the room right now? Could be my mind playing tricks. And I always sometimes feel like, ultimately, people aren't always looking for evidence. They're wedded to a worldview. And until that weddedness to that worldview changes, no amount of evidence is going to... Because you can always interpret the evidence in a variety of different ways. Andrew, do you agree with that?
I had probably the brightest guy I know, who's a you know, good friend of mine. I said to him when we were 20 or 21, I was describing telling him a miracle story actually that I'd recently seen. But he said to me, the thing is, if I was to believe what you've just told me, the entire way I look at the physical world would have to change. So I can't accept that statement in isolation, or even that the evidence you're trying to present to me. Because if I did, I would everything would have to go. And I think in that sense, it's the sort of, you know, there's a whole network and lattice of plausibility relating to our personal relationships, to relating to our desires and our often family choices and things, which mean that decisions about the larger the decision, the mind change about, I voted Leave 4 years ago and now I'd vote Remain sort of thing. Even that doesn't actually cost you your whole network. Whereas when we're talking about the existence of God or the divinity of Jesus, or, and actually some of the things even that you've touched on, John, in the sort of quite innate beliefs, which are now almost religious in nature in contemporary America and in the West, about the very, very high values on diversity and inclusion, and some of the things those things mean are so foundational to the identities of the people who hold them, that to lose them is not simply changing your mind, it's actually changing your life. And I think that the higher the stakes, the more, not just evidence, the more experiential encounter is almost needed to move you from one state to the other. And obviously in that sense, it's some people, it is like almost a religious conversion when they change their political or their ideological affiliation.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. I think we evolved to have minds that make things sacred. We evolved to then circle around those sacred things with other people. And in the process, we bind ourselves together. So I actually gave a TED Talk in 2012. If listeners will just search for Religion, Evolution, and the Ecstasy of Self-Transcendence. And actually about very much what we were just talking about how people have religious experiences. They feel that God has visited them. And I actually have some animations there. I actually took some of the text from William James' classic book on religion. Mm. And narrates these religious experiences. And I had a video artist animate them. So yes, if I had one of those in which I felt and deeply knew that God was real, God was here, God was a presence, that sort of visceral experience, overwhelming experience. And you find these conversion stories in similar form in Hinduism and many other religions. Well, then, yes, that could well change my mind, yes.
Well, look, it's been great having you on the program today, Jonathan. Thank you so much for making the time. And again, if you want to find out more about the most recent book from Jonathan, The Coddling of the American Mind, you can go to the website for it, thecoddling.com. And for more from Andrew Wilson, you blog regularly, I think, at thinktheology.co.uk. Andrew,
good
place for people to find your commentary, and of course those reviews you've had of Jonathan's books as well. But for the moment, it's been such a lovely time having you both in conversation today. So, Jonathan and Andrew, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both so much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to hearing what you thought about today's show. Do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find me on Twitter @UnbelievableJB to tweet me your thoughts and follow the show there. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want the Facebook page for the show and to leave your thoughts there as well. All of those links and more and ways you can comment underneath today's programme as well at the website too, at premierchristianradio.com/UnbelievableJB. Unbelievable. Do, by the way, tell others about Unbelievable, pass on episodes that you've enjoyed, and of course, rate and review us in iTunes if you get the chance. So that always helps other people to discover the show. In fact, I was just made aware this last week of another podcast, and it's called the Still Unbelievable podcast. Now, you may remember back in the summer of last year, I did a dialogue sort of two-person dialogue on each side with some folk who have banded together to create a response book to my own book, The Unbelievable Book. They called it Still Unbelievable. Now they have a podcast, and what they're doing is actually responding to, in each episode, an episode of Unbelievable. Interestingly, the first three they've decided to go for have all been just Christians on the show, into Christian debates. But it's hosted by the guys behind the Still Unbelievable book. It's available on iTunes and wherever you get your podcast from. And when I posted that up on Twitter and said, wow, gosh, I've apparently there's a podcast that exists to critique the Unbelievable episodes, a lot of people replied saying, actually, you should take that as a badge of honor, which I think actually, yes, I am honored to have a podcast about my podcast now in existence. So thank you very much to the Still Unbelievable crew, David Johnson and so on, who are behind that particular program. Obviously, it is just atheists that you'll be hearing on that particular program. You won't hear the range of views that you hear on Unbelievable. But what I like about Unbelievable is it does get lots of people across the faith spectrum listening. Goran got in touch from Massachusetts to say, I found your podcast by accident and have been religiously listening to it pretty much every morning while I take the long way to work. So I feel compelled to email you to say, great job. I look forward to spending my mornings with you and your guests. I'm an atheist and at first didn't know what I was getting myself into by starting to listen, but I'm glad I stuck with it. Appreciate your neutrality with the guests that are on the show. Also appreciate the thought-provoking variety of content you discuss and debate. I haven't listened to every single episode yet, so I don't know if you've already had them on, but I'd love to see Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins on one of your shows. Sam has a podcast too. Maybe you can get on his. Gosh, well, Goran, if you know how I can get on the Sam Harris podcast, I would love to know, because from what I've heard, he has a massive audience, and I'd love to tell them about Unbelievable. I have reached out to Sam in the past. Nothing's come of it yet, but who knows? Perhaps he will come on at some point down the line. Richard Dawkins has been on a couple of times, a little while ago now, back in end of 2013. He came on for a debate on the Old Testament. So if you search back in the archives, you'll find that. There was the episode where we reviewed his debate in Oxford with John Lennox. That's all the way back in 2008. And I managed to get a brief interview with him. And we've carried a debate he had with the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, at Oxford as well. So he's been on in various ways over the years, hoping he'll come back on again, of course. He still remains an important voice in the atheist Christian dialogue. Thank you very much. So glad you're listening. Always great to hear of atheists and agnostics and people of other faiths who download the show regularly. Mel got in touch via Facebook to say, is there a way to search for topics discussed on Unbelievable? I'm thinking about whether it would be a good resource to use in my school RE lessons. I don't always have time to trawl through lots of videos. Well, if it's videos you're after, Mel, rather than going on the Facebook page, you're probably best off going straight to the YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/PremierUnbelievable, and that's a fairly easy way to browse through the videos and see the various content there. We've got them arranged into playlists that'll help you to look through them as well. In terms of the podcast, of course, the Podbean podcast or Apple or wherever you get them from, usually there's some search functionality that will help you to search through for different topics and things like that. Again, the app is a good way to do that as well. You've got search functionality there according to different search criteria for podcasts. But let's turn to some of the response to last week's programme. That was Natalie Collins and Phil Moore debating complementarianism and egalitarianism, the Me Too movement, gender differences and that sort of thing in the church. Lots of response on, especially on Twitter, a lot of folk coming out for Natalie Collins, who was our egalitarian on the programme there, and a lot of appreciation for both sides, actually, in the way they conducted themselves. But a number of critics, people saying they were very dismayed by some of the comments that came out on the YouTube video in the comment section underneath there, particularly the ones that were very derogatory towards Natalie. And I completely agree. And I have deleted some of the ones that were the worst offenders, as it were. It is a shame, actually. YouTube seems to be, unfortunately, very often a breeding ground for the worst in people when it comes to the comment sections. But nonetheless, that's the way of the world sometimes, isn't it? Doesn't necessarily reflect the general unbelievable audience. But nonetheless, very good discussion. And my thanks to both of them for being on and generating such a lot of response. A couple of articles even, actually, immediately on the back of that show. Robin Bunce, I think, put out a couple on a couple of different Christian media websites, very much in the favour of Natalie Collins and questioning some of Phil Moore's approach to the subject. But there were comments on both sides, and that's true in the emails as well. This one from Jeffrey Jones in Hamburg, New York, says, on the subject of Me Too, Natalie Collins bemoaned that people still aren't believing women and dismissed claims that Me Too is an anti-male witch hunt. By implying that we should simply believe women, was Natalie Collins saying that if a male is accused of sexual misconduct, we have a moral responsibility to assume that he's guilty? How is that not misandry? At the very least, Natalie is promoting anti-male prejudice and should have been questioned on that point. She's literally saying that we should prejudge men as guilty. Are we only to assume that the male is guilty, or are we to behave as if he's guilty too? The latter necessarily implies a witch hunt. A man is accused of sexual misconduct. We believe women, so we all just assume that the man is guilty as accused, and we act accordingly, ensuring that he loses his job and is socially ostracised. If the mere existence of an allegation is all we need to say a male's guilty, where does that leave democratic legal principles, such as the presumption of innocence, the prosecution's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to confront one's accuser, the right to summon witnesses in one's defence, to respond to accusations, to equal treatment, to trial by jury, and the due process of law? I wish you had asked those questions, Justin. So, Jeffrey, feeling that that was an issue that should have been addressed more in the programme. Thank you, Jeff. Darren in Houston says, I very much appreciated you exploring the egalitarian complementarian debate. Unfortunately, starting out having a feminist represent the egalitarian position complicated the issue. As Phil repeatedly stated, she was bringing the world's solutions into the church. But I think it was also a mistake to approach it from the world's problems at large themselves. God's social order doesn't necessarily work in the secular world, and that's a separate issue. Even with a complementarian church or family, abuse can occur. Focusing on that detracts from the debate as well. Phil rightly said the rest of Scripture teaches how to do that from the inside out. The debate should be how the church should be distinct from the world, even if egalitarianism might make practical sense in today's sinful world. What we should be discussing is not what relational order is most effective in society at large as a matter of social science. Instead, we should be exploring how we should order our churches and families within a Christian community. I'd love to hear more engagement on those issues, but even so, issues within the church and within the family are distinct conversations warranting independent treatment. How it works within the church depends largely on your ecclesiology, more generally. That'd be very interesting. There are many resources in that regard. And what we lack is deep conversation around how that's worked out in the family. Phil put his finger on it numerous times, suggesting men don't know how to be men. This is itself another topic, perhaps, but discounting abuse and other sin, how does a man exercise male leadership in the home when a woman isn't as submissive as she might be? How does a man maintain his leadership and love a woman like that without being passive? As Jesus was never married, we don't have an example of what kind of husband and father he might have been. Would he continue to turn the other cheek? Would he leave the housework for his wife while he communes with sinners and serves the community? What type of father would he be? How would he raise his children? Okay, thank you very much, Darren, for that position. This, though, from Paul in Cambridge says, I think Natalie Collins did an excellent job presenting the egalitarian view, which I believe is the only consistent Christian position. This is because complementarianism is sexist. Sexism is a sin, and sin is incompatible with God. And the version of complementarianism presented by Phil Moore on the programme is politely sexist. To clarify, I don't think Phil Moore and all other complementarians are themselves necessarily sexist, but their ideas and ways of reading the Bible definitely are. If they're right about the Bible, then the Word of God is sexist and teaches sin. But the Word of God cannot teach people to sin. So if the Bible really is the Word of God, then the way Phil and many others interpret its claims about women in the church must be fundamentally mistaken. These sexist ideas are in Phil's whole approach to both the problem of the way the men have treated women in the church and the proposed solutions to the problem. Phil claimed early on that the solutions Natalie proposes are all external and therefore won't work, with the unspoken implication that therefore we shouldn't try them. Phil proposes that the solution we seek is internal instead of external. And this seems like a false dichotomy. Some of the internal approaches Phil proposes are excellent, but why not try these along with the external approaches? Ultimately, since humans are involved, it seems unlikely any approach ranging from prayer and discipleship to passing laws and electing new representatives will be completely successful. Sexism is sin, and sin will always be with us. Surely that doesn't mean we should do nothing about it. And later in the programme, I noticed that when Phil was talking about Natalie's ex-husband, his suggested fix was both trivial and entirely external. If only Natalie's ex had been discipled better, with a proper biblical picture of masculinity, then he wouldn't have abused her. I'm shocked both that Phil can believe his own words and that he fails to see the contradiction between those words and his claims that these problems can only be dealt with internally. Thank you very much, Paul, for your thoughts on that. Yes, as I say, lots of different responses to that particular show. And there are also plenty under the Facebook post that we put up about it. And of course, at the show page itself and on the YouTube video. So do feel free to check them all out. Going back to the last show of 2018, that was Kevin Pillau and Sam Adams talking about how a Christian evangelist and the secular gay mayor of Portland became friends, their unlikely friendship. Tim says, the latest show was a breath of fresh air in this age of polarisation. Kevin Pillau's approach is just what the church needs. I'm so glad to hear about it. Basically the same approach the early Christians had within their context of the Roman world, which in so many ways we seem to be slipping back into. And that is what won the day for them then. I'm a long time listener, and while I've listened to numerous other podcasts, yours is my favourite hands down. As our dialogue class at the Penny Retirement Community here in Florida is going to be studying your book from February, you'll no doubt be gaining some more listeners from here. I've put in an order for 30 copies of Unbelievable next week. Look forward to the interactions we'll have on each chapter for the following 2 months. Tim, what a lovely email to receive. First of all, your encouragement about the show that you listen to, about the podcast, and of course, thrilled that you're using the book at that class that you're running out in Florida. So thank you very much. I'm thrilled to hear that. Hope the participants get a lot from it. If you're interested, if you haven't got the book and you're interested in picking up a copy, there are signed copies only available via the Premier website if you want to order it from there. It's unbelievablebook.co.uk, and you'll even get access to the first chapter for free if you want to try before you buy, as it were. unbelievablebook.co.uk. Before I have to sign off, just one more email, this time from our old friend of the show and regular contributor, David Robertson. He hasn't been in touch for a while, but wanted to get in touch over the two Unbelievable programmes that dealt with Christianity and politics. The first one, you may remember, was James White and Jared McKenna discussing the statement on social justice and the gospel. And then we had Andy Walton and James Price from the Taxpayers Alliance debating how much the church should get involved in politics and the issues around the welfare state, taxation and so on. So this is what you say, David. I was somewhat confused by the last two Unbelievable programmes on Christianity and politics. I had expected to be solidly on the side of James White, but found myself much more persuaded by Jared McKenna. On the other hand, I thought I'd be strongly on the side of Andy Walton, but found in the first half of that show that I was more persuaded by James Price. Although in the latter half, my sanity was restored. Anyway, thanks for a couple of stimulating and challenging shows on a difficult and tough subject. Sometimes in a delusional state, I wonder if I'm the only person who's right in the world and question why I'm not automatically appointed ruler of all so that I can put the world to order. Then I remember that I can't even put myself in order. I need to heed Jordan Peterson's tidy up your room injunction before I go on to save the world. And to remember that it was Christ who came to save the world. We only get to share in that salvation. Have a great Christmas. Well, Christmas is done and gone, David, which was when you sent your email in to me. But I hope you had a good one and a good new year as well. And yeah, I'm sure we can get a show together at some point this year, can't we, David? Always fun to have you on. Do send in your thoughts as well about these recent shows, today's or ones from the back catalogue as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And make sure to check out everything that's available from the webpage as well, including our app, newsletter, and all the resources and other things that you can get hold of. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You're unbelievable. Coming up next on The Profile, two really interesting guests, Jack Phillips of the Masterpiece Bakery, at the centre of that gay cake case in the USA, and then his most godly beatitude, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, Theophilus III, talks to Sam Hales in the second half of the programme, also available on its own podcast. Next week on Unbelievable, we are treating you to some fabulous shows in January, because next week I'm going to be speaking to Oxford historian and fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, Dr. Alan Chapman. He's got a brilliant new book out looking at the last 400 years of astronomy. Loads of colour, fun, interesting stories across that, and about the faith of the various scientists who were part of the astronomical discoveries over those centuries. He's such a character as well. You'll really enjoy hearing him. And he's in conversation with none other than Lord Martin Rees. Yes, the Astronomer Royal here in the UK. Well-known astrophysicist and author. He's also got a new book out looking at the future of what technology and science will be bringing the human race. He's an agnostic as far as faith position goes. So they will just be having the most fascinating conversation on astronomy, technology, the past, the future, faith. Do join me for it here on Unbelievable. I'll see you for the show next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.